Welcome to Ekhatra Dialogue, a journey through timeless literature. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekhatra AI.
Okay, so today we're diving into a really big one. Haruki Murakami's The Wind-Up Bird Chronicle. It's sprawling, ambitious, just unforgettable, really.
Absolutely. Often called his magnum opus, you know?
Yeah.
And Murakami himself, he's often described as this architect of dreams and disquiet.
That's a good way to put it. He has this unique way of blending things, doesn't he?
He really does. He pulls from Western influences. You feel the jazz, Raymond Chandler, maybe even Kafka. But it's all filtered through this distinctly Japanese, often surreal sensibility.
Right. It's like he builds these worlds where the completely ordinary, like making breakfast or ironing a shirt, sits right next to this magical underworld that's always sort of threatening to bubble up.
And Wind-Up Bird is maybe the ultimate example of that mix. It's part detective story, part surreal fantasy, part historical novel. It's a puzzle box.
So I guess our task here, for you listening, is to try and unpack some of those layers. We start with something as simple as a missing cat.
Which sounds almost trivial, right?
Exactly. But somehow that leads us all the way to, well, deep historical trauma and a quest for identity. It's about confronting ghosts, both personal and historical.
It really is. In the beginning, like you said, it starts so mundanely.
Almost comically so. You meet Toru Okada, our main guy. He's classic Murakami protagonist material.
Passive, kind of mild-mannered, recently quit his job.
Just sort of drifting along in his early 30s, living in a Tokyo suburb.
And that first scene sets it up perfectly, doesn't it? He's making spaghetti, listening to Rossini on the radio.
Total suburban calm. Inertia, almost. He feels like someone things happen to, you know? Not someone who makes things happen.
But that calm gets shattered pretty quickly.
Oh, yeah. Two things, almost back to back. First, this really bizarre phone call.
The sexually charged one, right? From a woman he doesn't know, but who seems to know him intimately. It's deeply unsettling.
Totally unnerving. And then right after that, the cat disappears.
Noboru Wataya, the cat named after.
His brother-in-law, which is definitely significant later on.
A very significant detail.
So the missing cat is kind of the first thread Toru starts pulling. But the real crisis hits when his wife, Kumiko, vanishes too.
She just leaves, and the note she leaves behind is cold, distant. It offers no real explanation.
Pushes him completely out of his depth, and then enters the brother-in-law, the human Noboru Wataya.
Yes. The politician, the academic. He confirms Kumiko's with his family, but there's no comfort there.
None at all. He just flat out advises Toru to agree to a divorce. Ice cold.
And you instantly feel this abstract sort of evil about him. He's not mustache twirling. He's just corrupting.
Yeah.
Sterile.
Absolutely. And that conversation, that's really the point of no return for Toru, isn't it?
Yeah.
His passive life is officially over now. He has a quest and a kind of antagonist.
Yeah, but it's fascinating how his search, it doesn't stay conventional for long. He's almost immediately drawn into contact with these really eccentric characters.
They're like guides pulling him deeper.
Yeah.
Beneath the surface of everyday Tokyo.
Exactly. They pull him towards that magical underworld you mentioned.
Who stands out first? For me, it's Mei Kasahara.
Oh, Mei. She's wonderful. This lonely, observant teenager, a bit obsessed with death, works at a wig factory nearby.
She becomes this really unlikely confidant for Toru. Very grounding. In a strange way.
She is. She cuts through the nonsense, speaks these plain, sometimes brutal truths. She really highlights the loneliness that runs through the whole book, even in the midst of the city.
Then you get the psychics. The Kano sisters, Malta and Krita.
Right. And Krita especially is key. She reveals something disturbing about Noboru Wataya, the brother-in-law.
That he psychically defiled her. It connects his sort of smooth political persona directly to this deeper spiritual violation.
Yeah, it shows the emptiness he leaves in people. It's not just political maneuvering, it's soul-deep corruption.
But the character who brings the real weight, the historical darkness, has to be Lieutenant Mamiya.
Without a doubt, he's the bearer of history's scars. He shows up initially just to deliver a keepsake from Toru's late uncle.
But that's just the pretext. His real purpose is to share his own story.
His experiences in Manchuria. The Nomenhan Incident, 1939, with the Kwantung Army.
And his stories. They're not sidebars. They feel like the core wound the whole novel is circling. They're incredibly harrowing.
Brutally so. Being left for dead in a deep, dry well. That image just stays with you.
And witnessing that execution. The man being flayed alive. It's visceral, unforgettable horror.
And Murakami puts it right there next to Toru worrying about his cat. It forces you, the reader, to confront the sheer scale of this historical trauma.
Yeah, the argument seems to be that this kind of suppressed history, these wartime atrocities, they don't just disappear.
No, they fester, they curdle, and they manifest in the present day.
As the kind of abstract, cold evil that Noboru Wataya represents. The politician who deals in influence and control, not messy violence.
So Tora's personal crisis, losing Kumiko, it becomes almost a reflection of this larger, unspoken national trauma. The silence Mamiya breaks.
It really makes you wonder, though, faced with that scale of historical darkness, what can one ordinary guy, you know, the spaghetti cooking guy, actually do?
Does he just retreat further into surrealism? Or does he find a way to act?
Well, he does act, but it requires a radical shift. He finds this abandoned house nearby.
And in the yard, the well.
The sealed up, dry well. Remembering Mamiya's story, the well is this place of, like, extreme experience, truth, and death.
He starts going down there regularly.
Yeah, he unseals it and descends, and that well transforms. It becomes his thinking space, his sanctuary.
But more than that, right? It's like a portal.
Exactly. A portal to a deeper consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
Down there, in the dark, the isolation. That's where his real transformation kicks in.
He has that vision passing through the wall.
Right. Into that strange, dark hotel room. He meets the mysterious phone woman again there. He's crossing boundaries.
Yeah, and it leaves a mark. Literally.
Yeah. The bluish-black mark appears on his cheek, like a brand. Showing he's been somewhere else, touched by something other. He's not passive anymore.
He's marked, ready to engage differently.
And this is when Nutmeg Akasaka and her son, Cinnamon, come into his life. This is where he finds some agency.
Nutmeg is fascinating. Another mysterious figure connected to the war's psychic fallout herself.
Yeah, she recognizes Tori's mark, sees it as a sign of some kind of healing power.
And hires him, right. To use that power, his touch, maybe the mark itself, to treat these wealthy women who have this spiritual sickness, this stain.
Which sounds bizarre, but it gives him purpose and money, independence.
And Cinnamon, her son. He's mute, but such a powerful presence.
Like a silent witness, maybe Tora's conscience. It echoes the silence around Mamiya's stories too, doesn't it?
It really does. And then there's the bird itself, the wind-up bird. We haven't even talked about the title symbol.
Right. It's mostly unseen, isn't it? It's just this Cree sound.
Yeah, this mechanical cry that seems to signal, like, what, fate turning, the world's mainspring being wound.
It suggests these larger forces at play, which ties into that whole theme of free will versus, well, fate or determinism.
Toru spends so much time just drifting, being carried along. There's that idea in the book about not resisting the flow.
But understanding it, knowing when to go up, when to go down.
And after his time in the, well, after being marked, maybe he understands the current better. He knows it's time for him to act decisively.
Time to confront Noboru Wataya.
But not in the real world, not directly.
No. He realizes he has to face him in that other space, the metaphysical hotel room he accesses through the well.
So he goes down one last time, prepared for a confrontation.
And what does he take with him? A baseball bat.
Which is so perfectly mundane, so direct. A simple act of aggression against this complex, sterile evil.
He finds Wataya in that surreal dimension, the hotel room, and he strikes him down.
And the effect is immediate, both there and here.
Exactly. In the real world, Noboru Wataya collapses, massive stroke, irreversible coma. The metaphysical act has a direct physical consequence. It's pure Murakami magic realism.
Toru is rescued, brought out of the well by Cinnamon. He's won, in a sense. But the ending isn't simple.
No, it's really complex. He gets that final email from Kumiko via Cinnamon.
And her explanation, it's heartbreaking.
She says she killed Noboru Wataya, meaning she killed the part of him, the filth that had taken root inside her. She purged herself.
She's free from his influence, finally.
But she can't come back. She feels tainted, unworthy, because of what she had to do, what she became, to fight that darkness within herself.
So Toru's changed. He's liberated in many ways. He's definitely not the same passive guy from the start.
Not at all. But he's left processing this immense loss alongside his new self. His identity is forged in that trauma, but also in his resilience.
So if we try to distill it down, what's the takeaway for someone reading this or listening to us?
I think it's about how identity isn't just found, it's made. Often through facing really difficult, uncomfortable things. Moving from just watching life happen to actually, well, grabbing the bat, metaphorically
right.
speaking.
And it also shows how deep loneliness is. For almost everyone in the story, Toru, Mei, Mamiya, Kumiko. but those rare connections they do make.
However strange or silent, like with Cinnamon, or grounded, like with May.
They're absolutely vital. Maybe the only way to navigate the weirdness and the darkness.
Yeah, maybe the core message is you have to go down into the quiet, into the dark places, personally, historically, to really understand things.
You have to confront that suppressed stuff, the silence, before you can find any real meaning or true selfhood.
Sometimes you need the silence of the well to finally hear the wind-up bird.
This conversation ends here. We'll meet again with another unique work of world literature. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation. Outro music fades in.